Welcome to The Point. I'm Amy Vince in for Mindy Todd. It's our monthly Healthy Lifestyles program, and today our topic is eating mindfully. What does it mean? How can we adopt the practice? And what does the science tell us about its impact on our health and well-being? With us is Stacy Richman, registered dietitian specializing in eating disorders and practitioner of integrative nutrition therapy for over 20 years. She provides individual counseling, coaching, workshops, and retreats for women through her business, Kind Eating. Welcome back, Stacy.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Amy.
Remind us of what the practice of mindfulness is, and then what we know about the impacts of adopting a mindfulness practice on our bodies and our brains.
Yeah, sure. So mindfulness, I'll start with, say, a definition of mindfulness. And there's some variations in the definitions, but a good common definition would be paying attention to your present moment experience without judgment. And so there's two components to that, which is being present in the moment, being aware of what's happening in that present moment. And the second component is that piece around judgment, which I find in my own life journey and experience with clients is that little tricky part. That judgment piece is what trips people up a lot.
Yeah, we'll get to that more in a moment. I want to talk a little bit more about being present in the moment, because I and I'm sure many other people do so many things simultaneously, whether I'm cooking and listening to the radio or eating while I'm reading the news or whatever. So is mindfulness something that if you're practicing it, you're trying to do all the time, or do you set aside time for mindfulness throughout the day?
Well, I'd like to say, and I'm sure that we'll move into a little bit more of, say, mindfulness practice around the mindful eating. But before I get to that, I'd like to share a concept of how I see mindfulness and the idea of beginning to consider developing mindfulness practices. Is, as you said, we're very busy, engaged in our daily life. There's always something that's catching our attention. We're having thoughts all the time. Usually they're running in the background subconsciously. We're not always aware of what's happening in our mind. And I would like to think of this like stepping on, say, driving a car and you're pressing the gas. And you go, 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 and you're always pressing the gas. I look at mindfulness and mindfulness-based practices as a skill to learn how to step on the brake so that there's a little more of a dance between that go, 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 engaging your mind and learning to temper and learn to press the brake through becoming more present in the moment. So there's various degrees and ways that this would show up for somebody in their life. And it doesn't mean that you never would multitask again, but mindfulness could be being present to multitasking. And again, there's a lot of different entry points and ways to look at mindfulness and practicing mindfulness. And my hope today is expanding the accessibility and the understanding of how people can apply this without necessarily having to carve out a specific period of time to do an official type mindful practice, which we could call that formal, and we could call incorporating throughout our day informal. So it could be, like you said, on the phone eating and having a brief moment to say, wow, look at me, I'm doing a couple of things at the same time. That is in and of itself a level of mindfulness.
It can be that simple, it sounds like.
Correct.
So what do we know about the impacts of mindfulness practice on our bodies and our brains?
There's a lot of wonderful benefits to mindfulness, in particular how it impacts the brain itself and the different aspects of the brain function. One of the things about mindfulness is how it impacts the prefrontal cortex, which is our operating brain, our daily functioning, organizing brain. Mindfulness practices help us to stimulate that part of our brain to harness attention, awareness, which is what will help bring us more into the moment. Also, mindfulness practices stimulates a part of the midbrain called the insula, and this part of the brain is connected to increasing emotional stability and opening up to more compassionate connection with others. Also, by actively working with mindfulness, and we'll be, again, moving into the concept of that, the practice of it, involves slowing down. And when we begin to slow down, we can start to shift from that pressing the gas way of operating, which we could call the sympathetic or fight or flight way of operating, to the brake, which is more of the parasympathetic, that rest and digest. So it increases that tone of moving between those two nervous system components, our fight or flight or the rest and digest. Also, what we see through mindful practices is increasing various hormones in the body, in particular oxytocin, which is the connection hormone. And I also hope to bring in the idea of compassion, because I find that mindfulness alone, without having a sense of compassion or building compassionate practices, it ends up leading people to feel like they're missing the point or it isn't quite as rewarding as they thought.
And when you say compassion, are you talking about compassion for ourselves, compassion for others, both? What does that mean?
I will reference that for our conversation in this moment right now, self-compassion. Mm-hmm. Because if we're doing mindfulness practices, part of the function of mindfulness practices is to become more self-aware, to get more connected to our own lived experience, our own sense of being in the world. How am I operating? How am I thinking? How am I feeling? So when we start slowing down and we start discovering and questioning what's happening for us in the moment, mindfulness is about experiencing exactly what is happening. So if you become mindful and you start experiencing difficult emotions or uncomfortable sensations that are related to emotions or thoughts that you didn't really realize were there, compassion, self-compassion, is a way for us to learn how to tolerate some of the discomfort that might be there. So mindfulness isn't, hey, let's just slow down, be mindful, and feel all happy. What mindfulness is about getting more integrated, getting more present to your whole self, the whole life experience, including thoughts and feelings that you're having that may be uncomfortable or difficult.
Mm-hmm. It's just making me think. I feel like the world is so geared towards multitasking and sort of instant gratification and go, 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 go. It's almost as if many of us have just lost that ability to be reflective or live in the moment. So it almost, as you're saying, it takes more of an effort where maybe 50 years ago, 100 years ago, it didn't.
I couldn't agree more. And if we consider the state of our reality right now, and we think about just the dichotomy of love and fear, just that, you know, extreme dichotomy. Fear, one of the things that we know about the brain is the fear engages the fight or flight aspect of our reality, which is in our ancient brain. And so when that ancient brain is activated and we feel stress or fear, and this could be real or perceived, Our inner self doesn't know the difference between real or perceived fear. So if we have a fear-based thought, whether it's a reality or not, our body is still going to react as if we're being, that classic phrase, chased by the saber-toothed tiger. And so when we are in fear, we activate survival, that fight or flight, and we actually shut down access to our prefrontal cortex. And remember, I said that's the part of our brain that is the problem solver, the attention center. So just like you said, the more that we are engaging, it actually creates a block. And so part of the purpose of mindfulness, or even just the intention of exploring mindfulness or starting in very small ways, is to actually work on breaking fear response. So for a lot of people, they're not going to be able to access mindfulness in a what might feel a successful way until they learn to calm down the fear and relax their body a little bit more.
So if we move into mindful eating, is it helpful to start that conversation with some overall general practice of mindfulness? So, do they apply in the mindful eating context, or are they kind of separate?
I would say that it's a continuum. So in the introduction of the concept of mindfulness as we're discussing this is attention to the experience now, what's happening now. So, and happening now and not judging it, right? So we've got those two pieces. If we take a look at sliding that along the continuum to look at how that applies to mindful eating, we're taking mindfulness concepts and specifically focusing it on a particular activity, which would be the activity of eating. So again, mindfulness could be applied to the activity of washing the dishes, could be talking to your child, could be driving your car. So mindfulness can be applied to any and all aspects of life. We're taking this mindfulness skill set now, and we're going to just focus it in specifically to the practices of eating and the dynamic of eating. So it is all the same, but now we're going to look at how we can use mindfulness techniques to attend to the experience in the moment. So there are some interesting doorways that are unique to food and eating to help us become more attentive or aware. In particular, when we are entering into, I'll reference this as a relationship with food, we access and have to bring online, or we have the opportunity to bring online all of our senses. So if you think about our sensory apparatus with eating, we have our visual, so we can see what's in front of us. We have our sense of smell. We have our sense of taste. And we have a sense of sensation when we are eating food. So the one that's often left out that's the a common sense is also hearing, which we could include that to a degree. But you can see that we're trying to bring it in. It's a way to access mindfulness in a more focused way.
So walk us through. You're sitting down to, and maybe mindfulness around eating begins as you even start to prepare the food. But let's start, you know, you're sitting down for lunch with a sandwich in front of you. Just walk us through what should be running through our mind as we slow ourselves and try to bring ourselves into that moment.
I will tell you that my approach is really trying to make things practical and approachable for people. One of the first ways that I encourage people or offer exploring mindfulness at mealtimes is prior to eating, take one conscious, mindful breath. So sitting down and just breathing in and out as one way to slow the momentum, because it's that gas brake piece, right? Like you're going, you're sitting down, eating lunch. Sometimes, again, people are on the computer or they're not really recognizing that they're eating. So the breath is to create a momentum shift from whatever task you're doing to recognizing, oh, yes, I'm sitting here to eat. So one mindful breath alone can become a beginning practice for mindful eating. So I'll move along from there. If we use our senses, there can be a way to observe what's in front of us. Oh, I brought a sandwich and a piece of fruit, noticing how you're feeling about that. Oh, I'm excited to eat my sandwich, or I'm not excited, or, oh, darn, I wish I got that piece of pizza in the break room instead of my sandwich today. So our present moment awareness is observing through our senses, but building that observation and starting to become aware of our inner experience, like what are we thinking about our food? How are we feeling about our food? And this is, again, even before beginning to eat.
I'm sorry. I'm in the moment. I'm listening.
Are you listening?
Am I listening to what's next?
Right? Yeah, we're going on a journey, right?
And I am going to pause here for just a quick break and remind folks we are discussing mindfulness and mindful eating this hour. Do you practice mindfulness, or do you practice eating mindfully, or have you tried it in the past? Was it challenging? Share your story with us at 866-999-4626. The number again is 866-999-4626. You can send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. I'm Amy Vince in for Mindy Todd. Today, our topic is eating mindfully. What does it mean? How can we adopt the practice? And what does the science tell us about its impact on our health and well-being? With us is Stacey Richmond, registered dietitian specializing in eating disorders and practitioner of integrative nutrition therapy. If you have a question or comment or want to share your experience with mindfulness or mindful eating, give us a call. That number, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626, or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. And where we left off, Stacey, is we were sitting down, taking that deep breath before we began to eat and noticing what we were eating. And what are some of the next steps?
So, again, if this is a normal daily experience, taking that first bite and observing the sensation of what you're eating, chewing it perhaps a little more slowly, letting yourself stay connected to the experience of that food as you begin to swallow the food. Imagine if you could stay connected to the food beyond your mouth and really see what is there for sensation as it moves down the throat. Can you connect to the landing pad of the stomach area and then observe the after effect in your mouth? How the residue of the food is there, what is pleasant or unpleasant, how urgently do you feel drawn to take the next bite? If you're relaxing or stressed, are you distracted by thoughts about work or a worry thought as you're trying to pay attention? So that would be a way to apply it. And ideally, doing a few mindful bites, perhaps pausing in the middle, perhaps a moment of gratitude for this meal in front of you. It could be before, during, or after. So there's a lot of ways to personalize the intention to bring some mindful awareness to your experience of food and eating. I just want to tie this back to the brain and that fight or flight part. So imagine that you're running down the street and you're eating a sandwich while you're running. I mean, this is a visual of what a lot of people are doing, is that they're putting food in their body when they're really at a high level of stress, very distracted. And to think about, number one, how much somebody's chewing the food and actually helping your digestive process by, working with breaking the food down enough so by the time it gets to the stomach, you're really efficiently metabolizing your food. The stress, if it's lower, you will metabolize, assimilate your food without that adrenaline response, which shuts down the digestive process. So mindful eating, I'll go back, because mindful eating and the mindfulness, I do think, is getting a little bit diluted, overused. People have tried it. It doesn't work for me. And I really want to say, I want to go back to also that comment you made about relaxing. So if we could start to think about mindfulness as an opportunity to just relax the body, take a breath, slow down, become aware that you're sitting in a chair, become aware that you're about to eat lunch, that level of mindfulness is highly effective, because the point is that we want to reduce the stress response in the body.
So you've mentioned one benefit. So it's helping that slowing down, getting out of that flight mode, that stress mode, is helping us perhaps chew our food more slowly and able to digest and metabolize it better. But are there other benefits of eating mindfully, or is this something that people who want to maybe lose weight or break the habit of eating sugar, is it geared more towards those types of people?
Well, I would say I really would like to offer that mindfulness would be beneficial for every single person, you know, that we are in great need of this skill for the level of stress that we're all operating in. But specifically looking at the benefits of mindful eating, when we get disconnected from our bodies, right, and where the gas is pressed, we're go, 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 we're in our mind. By getting into a place where we can slow down, relax, we can start connecting a little bit more to our internal cues of hunger. So if we think about internal cues of hunger and satiety, or hunger and fullness, that is the doorway to answer the question specifically around, say, relationship with food. How can people consider exploring mindfulness to manage or modify their relationship with food? So when we slow down and we start recognizing what is the stimulus for eating, is this based on a physical need for food and eating? Am I physically hungry? Is this an automatic behavior that I just do every day? Am I feeling keyed up and looking for something to numb out, to soothe me through food? So the point of that slowing down is to show up at that doorway, the doorway of more inner exploration of what are the motivators and the drivers for eating. And some research that's been done looking at mindfulness-based interventions around emotional eating, binge eating, etc., there is a significant benefit to regulating pace of food, so slowing down, thus decreasing portions. Binge eating behaviors have been mitigated by mindfulness-based eating awareness practices. But a lot of the mindfulness-based interventions, specifically related to weight management, disordered eating, is far greater when mindfulness-based practices are combined with cognitive behavioral therapy techniques, which are techniques geared towards helping people observe their thought process and changing their thought process to a more harmonious thought pattern. That was a lot of information there. But.
Right. I want to back up a little bit to the emotional eating, because I'm not quite sure I know what that looks like in practice.
Sure. Great. So emotional eating, we're always looking to feel good. We're always looking to feel balanced and stable. And I mentioned before the stress response in the body increases chemicals in the body. And chemicals that are stress-related can increase heart rate, can decrease ability to think clearly, create confusion, create general unease, dis-ease within ourselves. When we are feeling upset and we find that we are looking for food, thinking about food more urgently, our drives to eat are more from the neck up. What sounds good? What do I want? When it feels automatic-minded, like almost not even connected to the eating experience, continuing to eat even though you're full, those are often indicators that the eating is more of an emotional-driven eating experience, especially if you can recognize it's paired with an upsetting emotion.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I do want to, I'd like to say something here that is really significant, because oftentimes when we use the phrase emotional eating, there's this automatic association that emotional eating is a bad thing. And I teach my clients that emotional eating is normal. Emotional eating is a natural, normal behavior around food. We celebrate with food all the time. When we're upset and we have a special treat, it can make us feel better. So emotional eating isn't in and of itself a bad thing. It's when we engage in emotional eating over and over and over as the main way to regulate our emotional state, is usually when it becomes problematic for people. Because we can use food to comfort and soothe ourselves. If we piggyback mindfulness here and say, if we can practice recognizing that I am so upset, I just don't feel like eating dinner, you know what, I'm just going to have ice cream for dinner tonight because that's, you know, that sounds really soothing. It makes me feel happy. I'm just going to have ice cream for dinner. That can be a very productive experience of emotional eating because it's conscious, purposeful, recognizing that it's being used to soothe yourself, but that the real issue and the feeling won't completely go away.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you describe the mindful practice, it sounds like something that I might be more inclined to do as I'm eating alone. So does it look different in practice when you're eating with your family or with a group of people?
Well, I would say that it's a good question, and I would have to say that would be very personal, because everybody's experience will be their own. And internally, being in a group, it can be a little bit more distracting to be internal, right, if we're engaging with others. But there's also a way that we can share in a community the level of mindfulness that this is a shared, nourishing experience. And you mentioned it earlier, it's another opportunity to recognize that when we are in a shared experience, that somebody made that food, that somebody was attentive to creating something to share that came from their intention of love and extending that to everybody. So by being in a group, the concept or your entry, the door that you enter with being mindful might be slightly different. It might be, wow, I'm really enjoying this moment. I feel so happy to be sitting here with these people. I love this famous dish that my mother made for all of us, her famous mac and cheese. I just love the flavor. This makes me so happy. So it's the same concept depending upon how an individual person might like to experience themselves in that group experience.
I'm just thinking about sitting around the dinner table with children, and who can notoriously be picky eaters or pretty clear to say that they don't like something. Do you think that mindful eating practice, such as asking kids to describe more about what they don't like about a food or what they like about it, could help them become more receptive to trying different foods or expanding their palate?
Absolutely. 5,000%. I have this activity that I do with children, I'd say maybe 13 and under, generally, and it could be themselves individually or offering it up for family. So I'll give you the format that I offer to families, and there's tons of variations of this. But I have a little sheet, and it's called Food Experimentation, and it's a chart that has along the top little pictures of the senses that I described earlier. An eyeball, what you see, a nose, and then taste, texture. And then on the left-hand column, we talk about what are some of the food experiences that you might like to explore from an experimental perspective. So I'll go, say, with classic vegetables. Maybe that would be one of the trouble spots. So I would encourage filling out the graph, maybe 1 to 3 examples. And let's just, for example, right now, say broccoli. So I would have families look at a chart and say, let's do raw broccoli with ranch dip. Another variation may be cooked broccoli with ranch dip. Another might be broccoli with cheese sauce. And I would then guide them to go through the food experimentation to identify what does it look like, what does it smell like? And then one bite for what does it taste like? And I have prompts. Is it sweet, salty, sour? So I give prompts with that. And then the texture. So how does it feel in your mouth? Is it crunchy? Is it chewy? Is it gooey? And then the final column is what was the result? Did you like this food, yes or no? And what I've discovered by doing food experimentation is that it's a way to break down what is liked or not liked about a particular food, and you're giving permission to not like something and to start becoming more self-aware that, like, I've had so many kids do these experiment homework assignments that realize, well, yeah, it always looked kind of funny, but it actually tasted fine. But they could never get past how it looked, mm-hmm. so they never allowed themselves to just have an experience. And to give permission that you don't have to like the experience, right? Mindfulness isn't about liking it. It's just about getting to know what your experience is. So that's a tool. And I've done that with families to do new recipes that way, like make a new recipe and they all move through the experience. What do you like? What don't you like? Or a brand new food or a new vegetable nobody's ever tried before. So you can see that this is a template for expanding into a lot of variations for families to apply a fun concept of mindfulness at mealtime.
And I like the fact that it is indeed mindfulness. I think I told you off the air that I years ago tried a mindful eating app, and There was one exercise where you take a raisin. I think it's at least a 5-minute long exercise. You take the raisin, you look at the raisin, then you smell the raisin, and then you put it in your mouth and you chew it for 3 minutes. And I have to say, I just shut down and turned off, and that was that. So it's really nice to hear that there are other options, and that mindfulness can be a practice that's as simple as just noticing what you like and don't like about foods. It's liberating. At least for me.
Exactly.
We have a call. Let's get to Teresa, who's giving us a call from Brewster. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning. I just wanted to say mindfulness has been a huge factor in my success on Weight Watchers. I also am following the Beck Diet Solution, which again emphasizes cognitive therapy for trying to think like a thin person, and so much of it revolves around being mindful. I'm the queen of multitasking, and that's not something you should do when you're eating. You're not even aware of how much you're eating. It's over before you know it. But to take that breath, to sit down at a table, or just even sit, period, even sitting in the car, as long as you're not doing too many other things, being mindful has made a huge difference.
Teresa, let me ask you quickly, was it difficult or challenging to get started? Because I wonder if it's more like a habit.
You know, as a matter of fact, the steps in the Beck Diet Solution of even like one day you put a little more than you normally would have on your plate and leave it there. And you're mindful that it's there, that you can throw it away, and the earth didn't stop revolving, you know, that you aren't starving. You know, being mindful of those kind of things has made a difference. But I did go through those steps, and I said, do I really need to go through these steps? I did. I needed to make a rule. You must sit while eating. You must be aware of what you're eating. Yeah. And with Weight Watchers, you also track everything you eat. And I felt a little obsessed with food then, more so than before. But it really helped me to focus, be aware, and be mindful. And it's made a difference. I've had the most successful weight loss I've ever had. And this is something I plan to follow the rest of my life.
Wonderful. How inspirational. Thank you, Teresa, for sharing.
Thank you. Thanks for calling. Welcome. We are discussing mindfulness and mindful eating this hour. Do you practice eating mindfully, or have you tried it in the past? Was it challenging? Did you have success like Teresa has? Share your story with us. The number is 866-999-4626, 866-999-4626, or you can send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. I'm Amy Vinson from Mindy Todd. Today, our topic is eating mindfully. What does it mean? How can we adopt the practice? And what does the science tell us about its impact on our health and well-being? If you have a question or comment or want to share your experience, give us a call, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or you can send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. With us is Stacy Richman, registered dietitian specializing in eating disorders and practitioner of integrative nutrition therapy. My son seemed to be born with the ability to identify when he's satiated. He'll even stop eating ice cream or a dessert when he's full. But at the age of 10, he still struggles to identify when he's hungry, and he often goes through a grumpy period until he recognizes that it's hunger. So what do we know about our innate ability to recognize hunger and satiation? And what are some of the reasons we become disconnected from those cues as we get older?
So I'd like to present hunger and satiety in a specific way. So if you could look at hunger as its own category and then satiety as a separate category. So hunger is the physical discomfort, right? Physical discomfort indicating a need for food. And when we eat to fullness, we have fulfilled that sense of hunger. So we no longer feel hungry. We've alleviated the discomfort, indicating that we've met that need. So if we go back to satiety, before satiety, there's appetite. Just want to put this in here, because appetite is the desire, and satiety is having met the desire. So hunger is the physical part. And then appetite is more the emotional part. So when somebody is having a hard time with hunger, there are hormones related to this there are behavioral patterns related to this. And as I mentioned before, we have a stress component that we can turn down the volume of our body's signals if we have too much adrenaline. So there are factors that can get in the way of sensing our hunger. One of the things that I find is that sometimes, depending upon eating patterns, the people aren't creating enough space between eating experiences to foster and nurture a level of hunger. We live in a culture of snacking, so that sometimes people don't go very long between even, and people don't think of, like, say, I'm going to go get a coffee drink. So somebody would say, well, I don't eat. I just, you know, eat my breakfast and I eat my lunch a little later. But yet they would go get something that would be a caloric beverage and not consider that that actually is some nourishment. So this becomes a little bit of a puzzle for people in terms of really taking a look at discerning hunger and fullness. So hunger, we would want to look for physical sensations. It could come from the mouth, the throat, the chest, the belly, really getting in tune with what those sensations are. Opposite to having met that need of hunger is, what does full feel like? Where is that full sensation? And you can see now we look at appetite. We can be hungry but not have an appetite, right? Have no desire. We could also have a desire to eat. Somebody just made some cookies, but we just ate a meal and we're full. So when we look at hunger and satiety and signals to eat or not eat, it's important to recognize that there's a dynamic here, not just of straight up hunger and fullness, but that desires play into this, that our body biochemistry plays into this. And you can see the function of mindfulness is just beginning to open up to this dynamic body that holds all of these signals for us, that if we can begin to get curious and show up and begin to observe what's going on physically, mentally, and emotionally, we're going to get clues about our hunger and fullness. Doing some personal tracking can be a way to dig a little deeper into this for people, is to do some food journaling and tracking, identifying prior to a meal what level of hunger you're experiencing. And you can use a scale, any scale that works, but say it could be 0 to 5, 0 is empty, 5 is full. And then noting how you feel after you eat. So if you start a meal and you're super hungry, you might say, I feel 0. And then if you ate a big meal, you might say, oh, I feel like a 5. So using hunger scales can be a tool to help draw people's attention inward to do a little more self-exploration around hunger and fullness.
And how long does it take for, you know, there's that adage, you know, slow down and let your brain catch up to your stomach kind of thing. Yeah. So what do we know about the timing there?
Yeah, that's a really great question. There is timing. I don't have any good, fresh reference in terms of maybe recent science, but it does take a period of time for the chemicals in our stomach, the whole digestive process actually starts in the mouth all the way down into the stomach. It takes a moment for those chemicals to get released and the chemicals to signal to the brain. And this is where... again, I could probably get some really cool recent research. I just don't have that at the top of mind right now. And looking at what gets in the way of those signals. So we have these hormones that tell the body, yes, you've eaten, stop eating. So if there's some dysregulation in the hormone pathways, and this is where we look at ghrelin, leptin, we've got a whole host of other hormones. People have heard of cortisol. But there's a whole interplay of what stimulates us to eat and what tells us to stop eating, which is, again, a whole topic unto itself. But yes, we need to slow it down. We need for the body to have a moment to secrete and release these enzymes and hormones so that the signal can reach the brain and we get the message that we have eaten. And the message from the brain comes back to us to say, you can stop now.
And I think the other thing that makes me think of is if we are mindful and thinking about what we're eating and how we're eating and our speed, we might be more receptive to recognizing that signal.
Correct. You got it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
We have a listener asking, is it possible to use mindfulness when drinking alcohol?
Totally. But here's the thing. So here's the thing about alcohol, because I do a lot of work with this with clients, that this is what I have observed is yes, to a degree, because remember that alcohol is a drug and it decreases So what happens is that our inhibitions are numbed out a bit. So what happens is we can be mindful of our alcohol consumption, but we're more vulnerable to our eating more is usually what happens. We don't have the presence of mind to regulate the alcohol the way we intend to once we start drinking. This is often what I find in working with people who are applying mindfulness to alcohol. Usually mindfulness around alcohol is more successful when there's a mindfulness around wanting to be mindful and they come into agreements prior to drinking alcohol. So the agreements need to be made prior to consuming alcohol to be most successful is what I've seen.
Yeah, that does make sense because I would think after two or three drinks, you've sort of lost the ability to even be mindful.
Correct, exactly.
In the past, we've talked about our tendency to eat the same foods over and over, you know, the same breakfast every day or a few dinner time recipes that we know we or the family will eat. Remind us why this isn't great for our bodies and our minds and how mindful eating could help us break this habit.
Sure, yeah. So the obvious when limiting the variety of foods that we're consuming, depending upon what that looks like, of course, is very individual, that we're also limiting a variety of health-enhancing nutrients that we could be giving our body and that every food item has its unique imprint of chemicals that are helpful for our body. So we're limiting the variety that we give our body. Also, you know, we do things over and over and over again. The experience that people have is that the pleasure factor of eating that food goes down. It's just not that fun anymore. And so that increases vulnerability to wanting to have more pleasure with food. So it sets people up, I observe, in you know more impulsive, pleasure-seeking experiences, which are often processed foods, to you know get that hit of a chip or some sugar or something that seems to be a little bit more exciting. So those are a couple standouts for getting caught in food jags. And so mindfulness is a way to start to recognize, oh, I'm actually, yeah, right, Stacey, I'm not enjoying this like I thought it was, even though I say, oh, yeah, I just make the same thing over and over and it's fine, I like it. But when we start slowing down, we might start recognizing, oh, I guess I am getting kind of bored of this. Maybe I want to try a new recipe or add a different color vegetable to this dish or so the mindfulness can be a way to stimulate the interest and the motivation to change things up and create more diversity.
And I was wondering, too, if you have any thoughts about how to stock your kitchen or your pantry for success. So you are eating a variety of foods. You're satiating some of those, you know, things that you like for pleasure and good nutrition, and maybe making sure you don't have in the pantry things that you know are triggers for you.
Yeah, I mean, just like you said, so here's the thing, whatever's in your house is fair game, right? Like, if it's in the four walls of your home, it's going to get eaten at some point. So really look at how you create your, I call your sacred space. This is your space. This is what you bring into your home is going to be consumed. So how to take a look mindfully, open your cabinets. You know, there's a phrase in yoga called beginner's mind. You could step into your kitchen and imagine that you have never been there before. And you start opening the cabinets and just observe, like, what do you actually see when you open your cabinet? What's the first thing that jumps out at you? And if the way that you're putting your groceries away or what's stocked in your cabinet are these beautiful labels of exciting foods that aren't the foods you want to be eating right away, maybe reorganizing so that you move certain food items into a less visually accessible place, such as, you know, snacks and treats and things like that. So doing a little mindful observation of your environment may help you reorganize things. So it sets you up for, if I open the cabinet, I've got those nice whole grain crackers and some healthy peanut butter instead of the Nantucket cookies or something like that.
Right. I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier in the mindful practice, either by yourself or in a group setting, is considering where your food comes from and also appreciating those who have played a role in getting the food to us.
You know, I had a young girl in here the other day, and she said she didn't like dark meat chicken. And I said, so what kind of, she said, I like grilled chicken. And I asked her, well, what kind of chicken is it? And she wasn't sure. And I said, well, it sounds like chicken breast. And she said, ooh. And I said, well, where do you think chicken comes from? And it was such an interesting experience, again, to go back and say, well, we used to have a whole chicken. Somebody chopped it up at home. And we're so far removed to the actual process of accessing our food. To take a moment, and it's a really lovely practice to do in a retreat-like setting. This is one of those experiences that is a bit more formal, to move your mind back in time to the origin of what it is that you're eating and all of the people that attended to that. If it's an animal, the people that attended to the animal. If it's a plant, picturing the field and somebody harvesting it and where that harvest went and what the processing looked like, and then where did it go from there, and what trucks was it put into, and who brought it to your grocery store, and picture the grocery people you see putting things out on the shelf. And, you know, so it's a very profound practice. Intellectually, we can understand it in conversation, but when you're in a meditative moment and somebody is guiding you to experience that more from an internal journey perspective, people are really moved. It can be a profound experience of honoring our food and feeling really grateful for the nourishment that we have access to that we take for granted.
It was also making me think, too, that if you try to do that practice with a more processed food, you suddenly realize that you almost can't do it if you look at all the different ingredients and ingredients that you can't pronounce and you don't even know what they are. It's hard to even be mindful about where they came from or what they even do in the food.
I agree. And, you know, I do mindful eating experiences in my sessions. And so I'll have people at times, not all the time, but bring in some of their quote unquote challenge foods. And I had this one woman, she loved candy corn. And so she was afraid. I said, but bring your candy corn in. And we did this experience, just really slowing down, like letting it sit in her mouth and melt in her mouth and swallow it, and then have her sit with the sensation in her mouth after eating the candy corn. She was blown away by the chemical taste that she never noticed before, because when you eat them quickly, you just get that burst of sugar. And there are certain things that she never realized that were actually not pleasant. They weren't pleasurable. And just that one experience, it really changed her relationship with candy corn.
Interesting. I might have to try that myself.
Exactly. So we start to pick up on, you know, and one of the other pieces that I want to make sure is mentioned is part of the function of mindfulness for people who feel that they have some challenges with food or regulating the amount of food they eat or eating foods that they, for snacks, they don't want to be eating, as an example, is that mindfulness strengthens the ability to put a delay between an impulse and response. And that's one of the big, big benefits in terms of mindful eating, is it allows you to slow down, to press that brake, and be more in charge of the choices that you're making. When we are in behavioral patterns and that we are just pressing the gas, go, 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 it feels like we're actually not in control of what we're eating. And so this mindfulness practice increases our ability to be in command and in charge of the choices that we're making.
Stacey Richmond. We have to leave it there. Thank you so much. I appreciate your time. Stacey Richmond is a registered dietitian specializing in eating disorders and a practitioner of integrative nutrition therapy. Her business is Kind Eating. We'll post a link at our website, capeandislands.org. I'm Amy Vince. Thanks for listening.